I want to read today a couple of letters about a Zoensing. One is quite long and the other is quite short. They're very different in tone, but together they pretty much encapsulate the whole path. I want to conclude this very sweet retreat with something that basic and encompassing. All right, this first one I've read a number of times, and I know it's fairly familiar, but even though you may have heard it before, please, as Sanchi would say, please give it your full attention, because it's really extremely fundamental to understanding the path. Books that matter, as distinguished from trash, are accounts of the experiences of persons reduced to writing for the benefit of others. If anyone wishes to learn, say, chemistry, he studies books on chemistry. Thus, he learns something about chemistry. But if he gets instructions directly from a chemist, he obtains a better grasp of the subject. Again, if he sets up a laboratory and begins to experiment, he will gain still better knowledge of the subject. And last of all, if he carries on his experiments under the personal directions of an expert chemist, he will avoid many a pitfall and will in due time become a chemist. Again, one book on chemistry may appeal to one student and may not appeal to another, for the mental makeup of the two may not be the same. One may have his analytical faculty developed, while in the other the synthetical faculty may predominate. A book, therefore, is not all comprehensive. The author has written it from the angle characteristic of himself, and it will appeal only to persons having a touch of the same qualities. Also, the same book may appeal to a person at one time and may not appeal to him at another time, for man is a variable creature, and his intellect is a variable factor. Again, there is the difficulty of exact expression and of correct understanding. You cannot convey a correct idea of a railway train or a modern motor car to a person familiar with only bullock carts as a means of conveyance. A radio agent without receiving apparatus will carry but little conviction as to the marvels of radio among persons who never before heard of the radio. Even with the radio set at hand, he is likely to be taken as a juggler. So when ideas about material things cannot be conveyed correctly in words, either written or spoken, ideas about non-material things, such as mental and spiritual experiences, cannot possibly be expressed with any degree of clearness and exactitude to persons who never have had any such experiences. Yet mental and spiritual experiences on the mental and spiritual planes are as real as are the experiences of anyone on the physical plane. A boy who leaves school after learning the three R's says knowledge is unlimited. A student who completes the common school course but who has not yet entered the university also says knowledge is unlimited. The graduate of the university also says knowledge is unlimited. A university professor who has encompassed the limits of learning afforded by all universities also says knowledge is unlimited. Now the boy, the student, the graduate, and the professor all use the same expression, but evidently they do not mean the same thing at all. The boy's idea of knowledge is very shallow, while the idea of knowledge as held by the professor is deep, a sea compared to a pond. Books, therefore, convey but little at best and are often misunderstood. The more critically a beginner examines books, the more discrepancies he finds, and the result is usually confusion of thought. Hence the need for association with a living teacher. Also the need for actual experience of converting theory into fact or individual realization. So books, by their very nature, are imperfect and serve but a limited purpose. Man himself is the perfect book, for all books have come out of him. Inside of him is the Creator with all his creation. Study of books gives second-hand information, while study of man gives first-hand information. That is, the study of what lies within ourselves. So why not enter within ourselves and see what is there? From the books we are to grasp the central or basic idea upon which the book is based. If you examine books in that spirit, I am not defending all books, and I am sorry to say that the English language is poor in real literature on spiritual subjects, you will find that the central idea of Saint Mat, and of other religions also, is the practice of the sound current. Many different names are used to express the idea. Christ, Muhammad, and the Vedic rishis practiced and preached the same. It may be said that they had studied or risen on the current to different heights, but the fundamental idea of all of their teachings is this sound current. The type of language or the setting in which this basic idea is given depends upon the place and the people the masters work among, their customs, the manner of their presentation, and their own intellectual development. And as these customs, manners, etc., change with time, the books go out of date. Hence the necessity of giving the same principle of the sound current afresh. The message must be kept modern, and so adapted to the times and people to whom it is offered. This current is present in man, all human beings. It is natural in man, not artificial. It can neither be altered nor modified, nor added to nor subtracted from. All else in this world is changeable and changes continually, but not this current. It is an emanation from, or wave of, the great source of all, the supreme creator, by whatever name you wish to speak of him. Each individual is a spark or drop of that same infinite source. The creator is at the top of this current, and the individual soul is at the other end, the current thus acting as the connecting link between them. By that current, the life, even the very existence of the individual is sustained. The individual feels no touch with it on account of the thick veils of mind and matter which cover it at this end. But it is there, in man and in all forms of creation, in the eye focus, whence it permeates the whole body below the eyes, and then goes out from the body through the various sense organs. To catch it, the scattered and scattering attention must be controlled and held in the focus, where connection is established with the astral, mental, and spiritual planes, and the same finally merges into its source at the other end. The first essential thing, therefore, is to enter this laboratory within ourselves by bringing our scattered attention inside of the eye focus. This is a slow process, but we are not justified in saying that we cannot do it, or that it is impossible, or that it is useless. Here is a worthy pursuit for the application of our critical and other faculties. If we cannot control and subdue our thoughts arising within us, who else will? It is our job, and we must do it, and we must do it now in this very lifetime, while we are human beings, for man is the highest form of creation. There are many ways of doing this, but from experience, saints find that repetition, called simran, done in the manner explained at the time of initiation, is the best and most effective way, as well as the simplest way. If thoughts of the material world take us out of the focus, thoughts of the inner worlds will take us in that direction. When we are inside of the focus, we have disconnected ourselves from the material world and are on the threshold of the astral world. We too have cast off our material frame, and we are of the same stuff as the astral world and are now in a position to function there. The same attention that was working in the material world is now capable of working in the astral world. And just as we now call this lower world real, we will find the astral world as real or more real than we now find this one. After reaching the astral plane, the same attention, now purified from the material dross, hangs on to the sound current, becomes further purified, and rises on it to reach the spiritual planes. With every inch of ascent inwards and upwards, the soul is casting off the coverings of mind and matter and is awakening from the deep slumber of ages. Needless to say that in this process, the soul is not helpless, but it goes in and stays in and comes out at will. We may look at this matter in another way. The Creator is existence, knowledge, and bliss, or power, wisdom, and love. An atom or a spark of this essence of existence is the soul, which, encased in its coverings of mind and matter, forms the individual man. If the coverings were removed from the individual, the soul would be naked and would be qualified to know its creator. The individual will know itself, attain self-realization, and will in turn be able to know its creator. Wrapped in its coverings, the soul merely hears of its source from others or reads about the creator in books, makes guesses, and draws imaginary pictures to satisfy its intellectual curiosity. It also manufactures creeds. If a lantern were wrapped in a thin muslin cloth, its light would be dimmed. If there's another envelope of thick, coarse cloth over the muslin, the light will be cut off entirely, and the lantern will cease to serve the purpose of a lantern. Man is much like a covered lantern. There is light in him. There is the spark of pure existence, knowledge, and bliss in him. But the envelopes of mind and matter dim his light, and he gropes in darkness. Real existence has degenerated and appears in him as reason, intellect, and instinct. Bliss has degenerated into fleeting experiences of pleasure and pain. Clothed in our dark coverings, we are incapable of understanding our source. And the extent to which we succeed in removing our coverings marks the degree of our capacity to understand our source. These remarks about the books, the creator, the individual, and the sound current will help us in answering your threefold question. One, the original home so often referred to whence we came. Two, why we left that home. Three, will we ever leave it again? The individual, as he is constituted now, is incapable of understanding what has happened or is happening at the source. The saints who come from that end and have access to that end at will know what is going on at that end. But by the very nature of things, they are handicapped in trying to convey information to the individual at this end. They attempt in various ways to satisfy their audiences. Some are convinced and some are not. No matter what answer is given to these questions, we can always find fault with it. And even if reason and intellect are satisfied for the time being, the necessity for converting theory into facts of experience and personal realization still remains. But the point is that saints do not wish to satisfy their audiences by empty words. They offer to take the inquirer to the other end and thus give him first-hand knowledge. One beauty of it is that at that end, these questions do not arise. So if the curious questioner would exercise a little patience and faith, most of his questions would be answered automatically as his experiences increase. Suppose a man finds himself at the bottom of a deep well where he is very lonely and uncomfortable. Another man happens to pass that well. He carries a long rope. Finding this man in the well, he lets down his rope and offers to pull the man up, if only he will catch on to the end of the rope. But our man in the well enters into argument with the man above and demands to know just how he came to fall into that well and what is the guarantee that he may not fall into the well again if he's pulled up. The utmost that the man with the rope can say is that he will take him out of the well and then he can study the situation for himself. But if the man in the well does not take advantage of this opportunity, it only means that his time has not yet come to escape from his imprisonment. Predestination versus free will. A will is free only so long as it is not acted. Once it acts, then that very act becomes binding on it. The second time it acts, it does not act as a free will, but as a calculating will, for it carries the experience of the first act with it. And a calculating will is not a free will, but a limited will. The very creations or acts of a free will work as limiting factors upon it and guide it in its future activity. So the more experiences one has, the more his will is guided and thus limited. And this is real predestination. There is thus no antagonism between predestination, fate, karma, and free will. We were free at one time. We acted and then our act became binding upon us. They curtailed our initial freedom. They now act upon us as unavoidable fate. Since our experiences have become complex and varied, these experiences now appear in us as joys and fears, hopes and desires, each of which in its turn molds or fashions our reason and intellect. Intellect, reason, and feeling, being what they have been fashioned to be, now determine our actions and make us choose the predestined course. Thus, the acts of one life determine the framework of the next life. Like farmers, we are now living on the crop we gathered last, while we are preparing the soil and putting in the seed of the new crop. Although we must undergo our fate, there being no escape from it, yet all is not lost if we use the little freedom we have in such a manner as to lead to our ultimate rescue. We wish this age-long wandering from life to life to come to an end, and so it will if we choose the means of escape. The easiest, the safest, and in fact the only way out is association with the free. Saints are free by virtue of their practice of the sound current, and they come among us with one single mission, that of connecting us with the sound current, and so making us free. And this is the only path of spiritual freedom. Facts versus theories. That which may be a fact to one man may not necessarily be a fact to another. And it will not become a fact to him until he has had a similar experience. Facts of Santmat are reproducible, like facts of any science, and can be demonstrated in the laboratory of Santmat. The laboratory of Santmat, as said before, is inside man. Anybody who enters this laboratory brings his scattered attention within himself at the eye focus, can see, feel, and realize what the saints say, and he can repeat the experiment as often as he likes. Santmat deals with facts only, not with theories or beliefs. It lays down a practical course for its devotees. It is practical through and through, and it can be executed by young or old, male or female, wise or simple-minded, while at the same time they are enjoying the fullness of home life. Life duties. Santmat is natural and hence rational. It expects its devotees to live a normal life and to do their duties better than others. Sluggards do not make any headway here or elsewhere. Santmat creates detachment in attachment, living in the world and yet not of the world. With mind under control, stimulated by a personal knowledge of other and better worlds, the disciple's viewpoint of life and of its duties and responsibilities changes. The life here actually becomes unreal, and its values are assessed accordingly. Things which others lay much stress upon become of little value to the disciple. And often that which others may consider valueless and even foolish may become of more value to the disciple than life itself. This is because he looks down upon life from a higher viewpoint. But this does not mean that anyone may neglect a real duty. Compared with life in the worlds above the eye focus, the life below the eye focus, our present condition, is no better than a dream. If people would go inside the focus and enter the upper worlds, they would become eternally happy. Empty talk would cease. They would contemplate the grand reality. So first you are to control your mind and rise within yourself to the eye focus, and the other man is to do the same within himself. When inside the eye focus, you and he have both cast off the material coverings, and matter is now no longer a hindrance in your study and upward march. Neither is it a hindrance in your communications with each other while you are both above the eye focus. To do this, it is not necessary to leave home or country. Anybody who goes inside of his focus is independent of time and space, and he can, from his own experience, give guidance to another who has not reached so far. He who rises still higher and has access to other and higher worlds is capable of guiding others to those higher worlds. As in all branches of study, a student who occasionally meets his teacher and converses freely with him has a distinct advantage over one who takes only a correspondence course. The same is the case here in Sant Mat in the development on this path. But the beauty of it is that when you gain access to the inner light and the worlds of light within, the elements of time and distance so completely disappear that you stand face to face with your teacher and master, and he will always remain right there to instruct and to lead you, as well as to strengthen you. You need not accept anything which does not appeal to you in books or even in my letters. You may leave aside for the time being the ultimate object of life and its how and why. You may start your inquiry from this end and then take as your objective the attack upon the eye focus. Reach that point as best you can, by this or any other method. Draw up your own plans if you wish. Only make and execute some plan to reach that objective. Bring your plan into action. That's the main thing. And then if you find it does not work so well, come back to this plan. The main point is to reach the eye focus somehow. You will be dealing with your own attention. If you succeed in holding it inside the focus, you have won the battle of life. You say in 8 weeks since your initiation, you have made no progress. Sant Mat does not fix any time limit. Let us appreciate the situation. Ever since our birth, at which time we left the eye focus and came out of it and established our connections with this world, we have not gone inside of it. Sometimes when we have a deep, intricate problem to solve, we close our eyes and try to think by holding all our attention in the eye center. We do it for a short time, but soon run out again because we have acquired the bad habit of always remaining away from the focus. Poets, painters, and musicians receive inspiration from this point. All great thinkers get their ideas clarified here. Whatever scientific progress the world has made has all been derived from this source. This focus, back of the eyes, is the fountain of all inspiration which has produced the world's masterpieces. And whatever further progress is to be made in the future, the source of information and inspiration will still be this point. Here is where divinity comes down to meet the struggling man. And what holds us outside this focus? Why does not everybody in the world rush with his utmost ability to enter this magic fountain of inspiration and wisdom? Because our attention has always been and is yet attached to our bodies, to our near relations, to our homes, to our countries, and to our pleasures, sometimes to our pains and sorrows. We have so much identified ourselves with these things that we have lost our identity. Unless now we start detaching ourselves from these outside connections, begin to develop the capacity to switch our attention on and off at will, we can make but little progress on the path. We are to reestablish our identity, to assert our supremacy over our minds and bodies. Mind must be made to work when we wish it to, and to remain motionless when we wish it to do so. We must become able to enter this body when we wish, to function in this world when necessary, and then to go out of it at will when we wish to function in another world. It is the attention which is to go inside and see. And so long as it is running outside, who is to see inside? If the owner of a house sits always outside of his house and complains that he cannot see what is going on inside, his complaint is not justified. This detaching the attention from the external connections is a slow affair. Habits become second nature. It takes time to form new habits, but slow and steady wins the race, and practice makes perfect. Follow your mind for a minute and see what keeps it away from its headquarters. Avoid whatever interferes and accept what helps in reaching your objective. I have already given you the saint's method based on long, long experience. If anyone is sure that he is on the right path, then if he takes but one step a day, he is still approaching his destination and is sure to get there someday, no matter how distant his destination may be. You will perhaps say, how am I to know that I am on the right path? I give you the means of proving it for yourself. Until you have proved it for yourself, you must, per necessity, accept something on faith. You would have to do the same if you were building a bridge. Lucky indeed is he who spends his short life in the Master's company. If a man is a true seeker, he should give himself up to the Satguru and drop all else. It has been said already how the attention of man is attached to all sorts of worldly relationships and things. There is hardly any attention left for the study of self and for seeking God. Look about you. Who has time for all the needs of his own soul? He should take time, but he thinks he cannot. His attention is so monopolized by trifles that he has no time for most vital concerns. A true seeker who gives undivided attention to the things of the spirit is a rare bird, but men follow after that which they love best. A lover cannot be kept separated from his beloved, for he has given himself over to his beloved. His beloved is his life. The quoted passages only point to the ideal. A saint is lucky if he gets one or two genuine seekers during his whole lifetime. And that letter is found in Spiritual Gems. I think it's letter number 157, although I may be off somewhat. But I read it from the July 1978 Satpani magazine, where it appeared also. And the letter that I want to read now, and this will be our concluding reading, called The Real Form of the Guru, is not in Spiritual Gems. I took this from the manuscript which the Sangat here published separately some years back, the foreign correspondence of Baba Sawan Singh. I took it from the original typescript, which somebody sent to me, I think from here a long time ago, and I published many of the letters in Satbani. This letter is dated July 23rd, 1919, 100 years ago, last July, by the way, and is addressed to Mrs. Brock. Mrs. Brock, who is, of course, the wife of Dr. Brock. They lived in Port Angeles, Washington, as I think most everyone knows. And they were the first disciples of Baba Sawin Singh in the West, and also his first representatives. They were both representatives, as this letter makes clear. Mrs. Brock also gave the initiation instructions, and many of the letters from this collection from Sawin Singh are directed to her. She never met Master Kripal. Neither of the Brocks ever met Sawin Singh, and they didn't even see his picture until 1927. They were initiated in 1911. And during that time, Sawin Singh wouldn't allow pictures to be taken until 1927. So they didn't even know outwardly what he looked like. This has to be understood in order to appreciate this letter. Dr. Brock did meet Master Kripal, but Mrs. Brock had left the body 4 or 5 years before that, sometime in the 1940s, I think. And Dr. Brock met him in 1955 when he came. So Baba Sawin Singh says to Mrs. Brock, "Dear daughter, yours to hand. I am glad to learn that you have imparted the spiritual instructions to Mrs. Spear at considerable inconvenience to yourself, but this work could not be entrusted to anyone else. This kind act on your part is greatly appreciated, and in fact there can be no greater charity than taking a soul out of the sphere of Kal Purush and showing it the path leading to Dayal Purush. It was very good of you to give your time to Mrs. Spear and Mr. Parson. They have both of them written to me, and I have sent replies to their letters. Mrs. Spear seems to be a sensible soul, and it is hoped that she will make some progress in the spiritual journey. Mr. Parson is also a man of determined and persevering type, which is very much desirable, as progress along this path depends on love and faith. And as long as these two are not perfect, progress is difficult. As for Mrs. Bridgman, her karma is very defective, and as the saints do not wish to give another incarnation in this world to their followers, it appears proper that her karma should be washed out in this birth. There can be no doubt that she is in great trouble. Still, the debit of karma must be paid off. Otherwise, it will become the cause of another birth. As a mother takes her baby to the surgeon to get its cancer opened, and it is not her intention to cause pain to her child, but to obtain perfect health for it, and without undergoing pain, the baby cannot recover, so the same is the case with Mrs. Bridgman. Please encourage her so that she may not lose heart, but bear her illness with patience and fortitude, making it to be for her good. Your statement that your husband and yourself, while traveling along the same path, have different experiences is correct. The karma of each is separate, and hence it is that while both are going the same way, yet the success and interruptions along the spiritual journey experienced by the one are different from those experienced by the other. Although much of your karma is similar to that of your husband, yet it cannot be so in its entirety, and hence the difference in the journey. Just as when the wife is ill, the husband is not necessarily, so the karma of each is different. The part you took in imparting the spiritual instruction was right. If it is found inconvenient to sit in a prescribed posture, then one may sit in any easy chair, with the hands in the prescribed position, or one may sit squatting and use a wooden bracket to support the elbows in the position. Mrs. Bridgman need not take the prescribed posture, but let her take any convenient posture in her chair or bed and turn her attention to the sound. The only thing is that a posture once taken should not be changed during a single sitting. I greatly appreciate that you do not dislike to keep aloof from society. As none befriends us except the holy sound and the guru, and as at the time of death no society can serve us, And why should we fall in love with societies and the things of this world? They were meant for our comfort, and so we should take service from them according to our need, but not make them idols of worship. True renunciation depends on the attitude of the mind. A man who, while living in the world and doing its work, keeps his mind free from it, can be said to have renounced the world. And one who, living in solitude, has his mind full of worldly desires, should be called a man of the world. Your desire to visit India is welcome, but what I wish is that you may have no need for your physical hands, feet, and body, but travel without feet, speak without tongue, see without eyes, and hear without ears, and while sitting indoors, visit not only India, but the whole of Brahmand. If you saw India with the physical frame, what use if you did not go beyond this world? If you reply that you want to come to India for seeing your guru, then it should be noted that the physical frame is not the real form of the guru. It is a mere dress he has put on in the world and will be put off here. The true form of a guru is holy sound, and in that form the guru permeates every hair on your body and is seated within you. When you will go behind the focus of the eyes, then the guru will meet you in his radiant form, and when you reach Trikuti, the guru shall accompany you in his sound form, even up to Sach Khand. Fly upwards upon the wings of faith and love, so that you may talk to him every day and be with him always. This will come gradually, so you need not despair. Perform your devotion regularly, and one day all these powers shall be yours, and you shall reach your true home. Yours affectionately, Sawan Singh. As I said, that letter is not in Spiritual Gems, and I again read it from the July 1978 Santbani. And it's important that all of the points that Baba Sawan Singh made in both of those letters are of the utmost importance as we move along on the path. And the point about the guru permeating every hair of our body and being with us every minute, Sanchi's final discourse, what I call his farewell discourse, the final talk he gave in the February 1997 group just a few months before he left, he makes that point that the guru never leaves. He never leaves. We may think he leaves. His body may leave, but the body, as Sawan Singh says, is only a dress that the master has put on. What the master is not and cannot be defined by the body or confined to it. And that is given to us. That is our option, to go within and find the master within. And that's what the path is all about. The outer master is there to help us do that, but he never leaves us. And once the connection is made, and not necessarily even, as we heard yesterday, the master had many ways to deal with disciples, and giving formal complete initiation in the sense that we know it is not necessarily required in order for the connection to be established between the master and a person. Even just a loving glance, or even hearing about him from others and having the spark of love enkindled in our hearts, all of those things can establish a connection. And once that connection is established, it never, never goes away. The master is always there. He is always with us. And we have access to him. We can access him. That is given to us. That's the point of the practices. Mrs. Brock never went to India. She never met her master physically. She did an enormous amount of work for him, which he obviously appreciates. And he couldn't entrust it to anyone else. But still, she never had what we took for granted. In Sanchi's time, when people used to go many times once a year, either to Rajasthan or after that to the city programs and then eventually to SKA, we just assumed that it was going to be like that. You know, this is the way it is. And yet that often was not the way it was in the history of many people. And here are the Brocks who had all this responsibility, and they never had darshan once. And Dr. Brock had, as I said, had darshan of Kripal in 1955, but that was it. It gives us some perspective to think on these things. And Sanchi said in that last talk that you will not get these opportunities again. Okay, so what we have to make use of. And we can make use of it by doing what he wants us to do, going within ourselves and entering the laboratory of the human body, all of the things that Tsao and Singh said in these letters, and finding him within. And that's both our mission and our supreme eternal bliss, is to do that. And we can do it. As Tsao and Singh says, you cannot say that you cannot do it, or it's useless to do it, or it's impossible to do it, any of those things. It's our job to do it, and we must do it, and we can do it, and with his grace we will do it. It's ours to do, and we will do it. When Judith and I were in India in our first trip in 1965, Judith complained to Master at one point that her meditations were difficult. She wasn't really doing terribly well with them. And Master looked at her and he said, look here, I want to come in to you, but you are standing in the way. How can I come through the door if you are standing there? And that was very helpful to her, also to me. So this is the factor. We have to be aware of how we stand in the way and how the things we take for granted, the habits we have, the fears we have, the desires we have, our habitual way of looking at things, the things we take for granted, all the assumptions we make about life, all of those things combined tend to prevent us from forgetting all that and going within and finding what is there. And yet that's both our responsibility and our duty and our supreme pleasure, as I said before. That is what is given to us. It's difficult to not express the reality of the path. The path is a path. It's actually, in my opinion, a superhighway, but whatever it is, it starts at one place, namely us, where we are now, and it goes to another place, namely Satchkhand. And from our point of view, the distance, both are within us, so that we travel millions of eternal miles, but we never go anywhere outside of ourselves. The paradox of the universe is very, very real. And nothing, I think it's fair to say, nothing is the way we think it is, because our perspective eliminates 99% of the universe. It's like assuming that an iceberg is that which we can see above the water. And we assume that, we soon find that it's not true. But that is the logical assumption that we would make if we didn't know any better. And when Santi, or the saints, or Baba Tsao Singh talks about that the saints go back and forth between this end and the other end, and they know what's going on at that end, but they cannot tell us about it because we have no apparatus for hearing it. All we know is confined by this world and our use of our physical senses. And if we can get past that and bring into play senses that we have but we have never used, then we can begin to understand the way the universe really works. There is a statement by a great Kabbalistic master about, you know, if we really understood what was going on, the nature of God, we would see this world as a mustard seed in the middle of a huge expanse. When we get to the world after that, that world looks like a mustard seed on a huge expanse. And that means this physical world, the Kabbalistic masters were well aware of the expanse and the vastness of the physical universe. All of the galaxies, not just the Milky Way, but all of the galaxies, that science now knows about, which are enormous and many and beyond our comprehension in themselves, are a mustard seed in the middle of the astral plane, which in turn is a mustard seed in the middle of the causal plane, and so forth. There's a story, I will conclude with this, there's a story that Cuckoo told me, the Princess Narendra, when I was at Sawan Ashram, I think in 1969. And I don't know if this is a historically true story or just a parable, but in any case, the point it makes is very true. She said there were two men who made it a point of following the master every day and doing everything he did because they wanted to imitate him. And so they started out, and master did, you know, a number of things, and they followed him carefully, observed what he did, and did what he did. And finally he went into a factory where they were pouring molten metal, and he took a bowl and some of that molten metal and drank it. At that point, they lost interest in doing what he had done. But that's the point, you see. The master is so much beyond us. He relates to us in the way that he does, and we love him, and it's a good thing. We're supposed to love him, and he's indeed very lovable. But the reality of him is infinitely more than what we can grasp. And that will be true up until we reach Sachkhand and become as he is. And that will happen. It will happen. But we can't make it happen. All we can do is do our best to go into the eye focus, as Sawan Singh says. Everything else is done by him. But our efforts to do that are in themselves sources of bliss and peace and infinite pleasure. And we can find the joy of meditation, as the movie title has it. We can locate that and access it and use it to help us go within further. And once we're inside, the master takes charge of us and takes us up as he wishes. And that is our pleasure, to go with him as he wishes. So it's been a very sweet retreat, and I have enjoyed very much seeing all of you, talking with you, and watching your performances, etc., which I enjoyed thoroughly, and eating lunch with you and everything. It's great, and I love it here, and I thank God that I've been able to come so often lately. Hopefully that will continue with his grace. Anyway, I thank you all for being here, and I appreciate your love for him and for each other and for me.